Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up for Monday, August 31st, the very last day of August. Hard to believe the summer's gone by that fast. I guess technically we have another week because Labor Day is until Labor Day is until next week, and that's the official end of summer. Well, not according to the stars, but according to the weather around here. So hopefully we have one last blast of summer weather before it's over. Got a great show for you lined up today. We're going to start off with a discussion about the upcoming BC Cooperative Association Summit for people who are in and want to learn about being part of a cooperative organization. Stephen Phan's going to be here in about 15 minutes to talk about tariffs and trade and all the fallout from the breakdown in negotiations and the relationship between the U.S. and Canada over the last 10 days or so. Gardening with Embark after that. And, of course, we're talking about the change in the weather, the end of the summer and the change in the weather there as well. And then Peter R.H. will be up just towards the end of the show with his bit. So all that more happening up here on the show. But let's get started with our first story. Madeline Reed is the communications officer for the British Columbia Cooperative Association, which is a cooperative, in fact, that represents and advocates on behalf of cooperative organizations in the province. And they have a summit coming up next month in the middle of September. And I had a chance to talk to her last week about cooperatives and the upcoming summit. All right, joining me now is Madeline Reed, who's the Community Engagement Officer for the BC Cooperatives Association. We're here to talk about the BC Cooperatives Association's upcoming Further Together Summit for Cooperatives. That's happening next month on September 17th and 18th. But before we get into that, I wanted to dig into a little bit about just what cooperatives are. We've all heard about cooperatives. There's lots of them that come in the news from now and again and whatnot. But what does being a cooperative mean, and how is it organized?
Yeah, great question. So a cooperative, sort of the by definition, is a association of people that come together to serve some kind of common need. And so if you think about a co-op, it has sort of three key components. There's a community of people that have some kind of need that they need to meet, and they can do that together using some kind of cooperative method. And so what that looks like in practice is you can have, for example, a company where the workers all own the business together, rather than having, say, in the case of a union where you have the union provides support for like collective bargaining against, or, you know, in conversation with the company. In this case, the workers actually own the company themselves. Right. You can also have cooperatives that are owned by consumers. So, for example, a credit union is a bank that's actually owned by the people who use the banking services. Or if you have a food co-op or like a car co-op like Modo, it's the people actually using that service, either purchasing the groceries or driving those cars, that are all as a community collectively owning that resource or business together. So it's a really amazing way for community to own a business, and a key, or a nonprofit, they can be both. And a key aspect, I think, that differentiates cooperatives from other types of organizations is that the members, or the community that owns the cooperative, they all have an equal vote. So it's a very democratic form of ownership. Everyone gets an equal say in electing the board, who then takes, you know, makes the key decisions that impact the cooperative. And in the case of profit sharing, if a co-op makes a profit, that money also will get redistributed back into the community. So it's really good for supporting community wealth building, for supporting distribution of power, of wealth, and ownership.
So cooperatives are really involved in a quite a broad range of activities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. I mean, that's, I think, the beauty of the cooperative model is it's so adaptable. We just talked about two different forms of cooperatives. You know, there's the consumer or the worker. Cooperatives can also be owned by a group of businesses. In the case of the BC Cooperative Association, where I work, we are a cooperative of the co-ops of BC. So the variety of cooperative organizations across the province are all members of ours, and then we work to support those members. So that's another form, is that, yeah, organizations can be owners of a co-op as well. And there's so many co-ops across different industries. So we talked about food and transportation, banking services. Also, there's, for example, there's New Roots Cooperative, which is a cooperative of tree planters. So it's a tree planting company that's owned by the planters. Or you can have gas co-ops, you can have fishing co-ops, housing co-ops is the one that people often are most familiar with. Mm-hmm. But really, if you, any type of business or nonprofit organization, for the most part, you could probably think of a way to make it cooperative.
Why might folks want to choose a cooperative model? They have a project they want to do, as opposed to, say, a regular nonprofit or organizing as a private company.
Totally. There's a lot of reasons. I think affordability can be one, for example. I think housing co-ops are such a good example of this, especially in, you know, in the Lower Mainland, where housing is so expensive. A housing co-op is a way to try and secure rents so that they mm-hmm. can be actually affordable and affordable for long periods of time for a particular community. You may also have cultural needs that you want to meet as a collective. So, for example, in the case of, I believe it's Muslim culture. I'm trying to remember the actual fact now, but in Muslim culture, it's important for loans to not have interest. And at a typical bank, that might not be something that's ever on the table. But then, so if a Muslim community can come together and form a credit union that operates in alignment with their cultural practices, which it can be super, you know, obviously really important for folks. It's also a way to, I think, do business differently. I think, you know, a lot of people, myself included, are feeling very frustrated by the sort of dominant, exploitative, working capitalist culture that we have that strips people of often their rights and their autonomy, and also can take a lot of the profit and put it elsewhere, or take it out of communities and take it out of the hands of those actually laboring and doing the production. And so this is a very tangible way for folks to take back ownership of their workplaces, democratize the workplace, and feel like what they're doing is important, and they're actually getting the value back that they're putting into their workplace, for example.
Right. So perhaps you've already answered this, but what does the cooperative movement offer society that other forms of organization don't? I mean, some of it is the flexibility you've talked about of doing business in a way that's different than a for-profit model. But what does it offer society?
Yeah, I think it offers, so something I didn't talk about as well that's very unique to cooperatives is that cooperatives around the world all follow the same seven cooperative principles. And I think, and I won't go into all of them in detail or anything, but it's easy to look those up. But I think what they do is they provide a framework of guidelines that center community, center economic prosperity for a community. Often there's more of a focus on sustainability. And so when we're thinking about trying to build sustainable futures and resilient communities, then cooperatives offer, I think, like a structural framework for how to actually implement that in practice. And I think when we're talking about, you know, things like in rural communities, lots of industry is shutting down or people are moving out, there's not a lot of opportunity. When we're thinking about the tariff challenges that we're facing with international partnerships and needing to build local reliance and local resiliency, cooperatives offer a means for people to be able to take ownership of the things in their community that they care about so that those communities can continue to not only survive, but ideally thrive and prosper.
Great. So the BCCA mm-hmm. Has an upcoming conference for cooperatives and people involved in cooperatives, the Further Together Summit. Can you tell me more about that and who's it for?
Yeah, totally. So as you mentioned, yes, we have this Further Together Summit. And The reason we've called it that is we really, in the cooperative movement, it's obviously about working collectively. And so as a move, and one of the cooperative principles is actually called cooperation among cooperatives. And so it's this idea that, yes, we want to work together within our cooperatives, our own cooperatives, but we also want to work together as a sector and a movement. And so by bringing everyone together on September 17th and 18th, we're hoping to create an environment where folks can have generative conversations and build relationships so that we can actually work together as a sector to be more successful. And so it's definitely a co-op focused agenda. We have lots of different content around both accessing capital, finding ways to support cooperatives financially, and also governance and leadership. So how do we lead our cooperatives collectively and democratically? And so it's definitely good if you have a bit of a cooperative background, but we're really excited to welcome anyone who's interested in learning about, you know, alternative forms of doing business, democratic ownership, sustainable social enterprise, all these different sort of related areas. It's really open to anyone, but just know that we will be taking a very cooperative leaning as we're talking about things. So that's something I think to get excited about.
Mm-hmm. So this be an appropriate conference for someone who's, or look, some folks who are saying, oh, maybe this is a model that would work for us. Would this be appropriate for them?
Totally. I think this would actually be an amazing opportunity to be able to learn a bit more about what is possible when you employ the cooperative model, and also to meet a bunch of different people from all across the province who are doing all different kinds and running all kinds of cooperative organizations, sort of like what we talked about in the beginning. There's so many different ways that you can use this model. And so this is a really cool opportunity to meet folks from across the province, from across the Lower Mainland, get some inspiration. There will also be folks from the funding side, so, and lending side. And so if you have a cooperative idea and you want to learn a bit more about how you can get that idea off the ground, this is actually a really, really good place to learn more about that. We have workshops during the Access to Capital themed day, which is the first day of the conference, that are about how do you prepare to your business plan so that you can actually get grants or get the loan from a credit union, or how do you build the story around your cooperative to be able to get people interested in understanding what you do, and also how do you work with other cooperatives to support your cooperative. So there's lots of different I think learning opportunities for folks no matter where they are in their co-op journey.
I noticed you had a special rate for youth for anyone 30 and under. Can you tell me about that?
Yes. And we actually just launched an even more special rate for some very lucky youth. So we have a special youth rate, which is for folks 30 and under. And that ticket is $150, which is less than half of the price of a regular member ticket. And that covers your entire conference pass, so all of the events and activities, and it also includes breakfast and lunch and a reception for both days. And yes, so that's what that covers, the $150. But we have also just launched a ticket giveaway for two youth passes. So, and what that means is somebody will win two passes so they can bring a friend. And we will also include a hotel room, because I don't think I mentioned this yet, but the conference is in Abbotsford. So if you're located more, you know, towards Vancouver or Burnaby, it's a bit of a commute. So we wanted to make that easier to provide by providing a hotel room for free at the conference center. And so if you would like to enter into this giveaway, what anyone can do is they can email us. And our email is connect@bcca.coop. And in that email, just say you're interested in being entered into the giveaway and just give us one sentence about why you'd really like to attend the conference. And then we will do that draw on September 11th, a week before the conference. And then some lucky winner will get two passes and a free hotel room for the duration of the event.
Great. So hopefully, maybe there will be a lucky winner for that.
Yes.
How does everyone else find out about the conference and learn more and get registered?
Totally. If you would like to learn more and get registered, you can head to bcca.coop/together. And on that webpage, it has all of the workshops, all of the keynote speakers who will be there, and all of the various conference details you need in order to feel informed about your stay.
So say that address again.
Yes, bcca.coop/together.
Excellent. Thanks so much for talking to me about this today. And it's September 17th and 18th, so
correct.
Coming up next month. So people, if they're intrigued now, they should jump on the internet and start finding out right away. Are there early rates and late rates?
We just passed the early bird deadline, so now we're on to the regular rates. But the student rate is consistent, the youth rate for 30 and under has not changed. So it's still a good more affordable $150.
Great. Well, thanks so much for joining me today, Madeline Reed of the BC Cooperative Association. And you're the community engagement officer?
Yeah, officer.
Manager?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining me today, and good luck with the conference for the summit.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great to be here.
Thank you. And that conference that conference is coming up at the middle of September 17th and 18th, and you can find more about it at the BC Cooperative Association website, which is bcca.coop. All right, we have both Stephen and Peter in the studio here.
Excellent.
And Stephen's here to talk about tariffs and trade and stuff. What are you talking about with your segment at the end of the show?
I'm talking about a bit of a conservative show. It's a half-hour show. Stations get it free. I think they even the people doing the show pay to be on. It's sort of like a Christian show, but when you hear it every week, it's a half hour, and people.
So you mean church?
No. It's called American News Radio Journal. It's sort of a comprehensive, from their perspective, conservative of the, but I'll get All right. into a bit of what the show's like and so on.
That's coming up at the end of the show. But Stephen Fan's here to talk about all the tariffs and the fallout from the collapse of negotiations between Canada and the U.S. around trade. And so.
Yeah, I actually got a phone call from my MP yesterday or the day before, fundraising purposes. So that's a party political phone call, not an MP. Just want to be clear because I'm associated with his party. But the interesting discussion was apparently there is the potential for an election sometime in the near to medium term future, which is interesting to me in the context of tariffs, because it would suggest that there's a very serious possibility, in fact, there might be a probability, that the government does not foresee any renewal of the USMCA, USMCA, NAFTA structure, and you would be in terra incognita, in completely unknown territory. And I think the government has its own preferred plans on what to do. It might just simply prefer to exist without NAFTA, to exist outside of it. That might, in fact, be better for Canada in the long run, but that's the sort of thing you have to take to the country in a general election.
So at the current moment, we've had the breakdown in negotiations, which were not about CUSMA itself, but about some additional tariffs on products that were outside of the free trade agreement. The idea that CUSMA is supposed to be renewed. I mean, my understanding is it goes on. It will carry on year to year, so to speak, until it's formally canceled for X number of years.
It will continue indefinitely until a set date or it's canceled. But I think the breakdown in negotiations were not really about specific tariffs. What happened, I think, was the American side, Jameson Greer and Howard Lutnick, inserted a number of last-minute provisions, which were not necessarily in connection with Canada-United States trade, but were effectively restrictions on Canada's ability to negotiate other trading relationships with other trading partners, mostly China. So like it's you know, I think last time USMCA USMC was renewed, there was kind of already had agreed to a fairly significant concession. This was 2022, yeah, during the Trudeau era, where they just agreed that if they were to enter into a free trading agreement with another economic entity that was deemed not to be a free economic system, so China, there's a right of other partners to exit. There has to be notification, whatever. It's kind of a weird formal thing. It doesn't really matter in practice because Canada is not signing a FTA with China, and you know what does notification even mean? But I think the American side has just decided to take this thing further and to actually implement binding and binding restrictions that bite. And this is like a real live issue, as you know. Chinese EVs are coming into the Canadian market later in the year.
Yeah.
You know, is the global economy going? Carney has made a speech at Davos about the nature of future trading relationships. This is a real life choice. And I think, obviously, the American side, quite reasonably for them, are trying to use the pretext of renewing an existing economic arrangement with the United States to consolidate that arrangement and to prevent any genuine diversification on Canada's part. Is it in the Canadian interest? And I think this is where the potential for a general election does come in, because think about the nature of NAFTA as it exists. It came out really like the trilateral Canada-United States-Mexico NAFTA signed in 1994 was not something Canada wanted. Canada already had the 1988 free trade agreement with the United States. In fact, that is something that the Canadian, the Brian Mulroney and the PC party, his private progressive conservative government, had fought an entire
1988 agreement.
Yeah, that's what they had fought an entire national election over, the 88 election.
Yeah.
And 1994 was kind of a weird thing where really certain elements within the United States government would like to include Mexico in the trading relationship, and Canada just went along.
This was a period sort of really at the beginning of the globalization movement to try.
Yeah, it was kind
and
of.
And I imagine partly motivated by the desire to access tariff-free access to cheaper Mexican labor.
It's, that's generally how it's described. I would say that, at the time there was a genuine vision for a hemispheric trading entity. I think Hillary Clinton famously said, if she had her way, there'd be free trade from all the way from Canada down to Chile. Mm-hmm. But that was the nucleus, the genesis of that, U.S., Canada, Mexico. And it was kind of a really nice, interesting experiment. One country speaks Spanish, one country is Anglophone, another country is Anglophone and Francophone. How does that work? I think it worked for its stated purposes. Mm-hmm. For as the basis of deeper integration, as would have been the case, say, in the European Union, that just didn't happen.
Yeah.
Partly just because I think China basically stole everyone's thunder. It just all the different things that were supposed to happen at the level of supply chain integration in Monterey or whatever just went to Shenzhen instead. So that's also just something that happened in the 1990s. Fast forward today, Mexico is where it is, and it actually has a much more significant trading relationship with the rest of the world. When I was in Mexico City, there were BYD cars in taxi fleets everywhere, so on and so forth. It's still 20% of the market. I think that the question of Canada is essentially, but even the 88 agreement was a little bit weird in the sense that there are two things happening here. The first thing is that the Auto Pact is longstanding. It's been there for decades, and that's really
something that started in the 50s or perhaps
50s
or
60s. Yeah, and it's about an integrated North American auto manufacturing sector originally around the Great Lakes.
Yeah. Because prior to that, Canada had branch plants, and they'd be making cars entirely for the smaller market in a way that wasn't that efficient. And it, so it kind of made sense.
Yeah, Canada had its own, it's kind of Australia. It didn't really work.
Yeah.
Great Lakes. And then there was kind of this idea around, you know, Detroit, Michigan, Lake America. I don't know. I just couldn't help. But like the... But that was the original genesis, and 88 was trying to do two things. For the first thing it was trying to do was really fully entrench the Auto Pact, because at the time it was working reasonably well for Canadian and American auto workers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, actually Toyota and Honda and other Japanese entrants had adapted to that. Yeah. And built their own plants in Ontario and in the United States. And also to try to extend that model across the entire economy. And in this sense, the 88 agreement is actually a little bit like NAFTA for Mexico, but for us, it just didn't work.
Right.
The auto sector stayed very, very integrated. The rest of the economy just didn't integrate.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, Canadian exported tradables to the United States that are products and not services. And are like of a nature where you could actually tariff it. So like autos, you can't really tariff oil and petroleum because there's no point. You'd just be hurting yourself.
Yeah.
It's just really still just autos.
Yeah.
And certain other very niche sectors like helicopter parts, aeronautics, things like that. But that's not very tariff sensitive. So like my point is that we kind of did our own thing that on a smaller scale, which is what the North American Free Trading Agreement tried to do with integrating Mexico into the North American macroeconomy, but it didn't work for us either. We didn't really manage to integrate the rest of the economy with the Americans. What's really happened in the interim is that the strength of the Canadian economy has been the big financial sector that's been able to go abroad and buy up a bunch of assets, Ontario teachers, the banks, insurance companies. So anyways, to get to the current point, there's a couple of things happening today, which is that the first thing is that the North American auto sector is probably in terminal decline at this point. And, you know, it's American administrations across both parties have made it very, very clear that they intend to repatriate as many jobs in the auto sector as they could.
If that's the case, that the North American auto sector is in decline.
Yeah.
How does these tariffs help that broader situation? Like, with all the disruption they're going to cause to the highly integrated supply chains for the cars. So, you know, in theory, those North American auto jobs, in theory, as a result of tariffs, would move back to the States.
Yeah.
But the cost of that's going to be huge to rearrange supply chains, build new factories. How's that actually going to help the overall industry?
Well, if it
as a whole entity is under threat.
So as a first thing, it's probably not going to build a lot of new factories, because it's more that certain factories will be spared from cuts or have fewer cuts, and other factories will be cut entirely. I was working on a deal in Oshawa, and it's the GM plant there basically doesn't exist anymore. You know, that was the headquarters of General Motors Canada. But like the thing is, was a very interesting thing. What I was trying to say is, I think it's a kind of epistemological question, because I think when I say the North American auto sector is in terminal decline, the implication people would typically reach for is in decline, you know, compared to what? And right. People always kind of assume I just mean China or international competition or whatever. But I think, you know, if anything, the Japanese experience has shown that that's not necessarily the determinative thing, because the Japanese manufacturers came here and established manufacturing plants. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that's the issue. What's really happening is that there's a weird technological angle. So the big discussion about transition from ICE, so internal combustion engine, to electric vehicle, EV, is always kind of stated in terms of environmentalism. But actually the bigger effect on society and the economy is simply that EVs don't require very much service.
Yeah.
So something like 50% of American auto dealer revenues nowadays in 2026 are aftermarket service.